Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Hi, you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI, a socialist radio show and podcast from members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. I'm Michael Carter. My pronouns are he and his and him, and I'm a socialist organizer and operative interested in revolutionary leftist politics. Today, we have Simone Norman with us to tell us about her experience working as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's fundraiser, what we need money for in our grassroots campaigns, and how to effectively get it without relying on the 1% real estate or business interests. But first, the headlines with Jack Devine.
What's good, New York? This is Jack Devine with Revolutions Per Minute headlines brought to you by The Thorn. Cuomo and the state legislature agreed to an annual state budget that included implementing congestion pricing in Manhattan, a reduction, but unfortunately not an elimination, of cash bail, and a plastic bag ban across the state. However, a tax on wealthy people's second homes was killed thanks to real estate industry lobbying. But a mansion transfer tax that mandates a one-time levy on expensive home sales was included in the final budget. In January 2019, there were over 63,000 homeless people sleeping each night in the New York City municipal shelter system, while over 24,700 apartments remained vacant across the city. So, is capitalism really a rational system of allocating resources, or just the means of accumulating wealth and power for the ruling class? In what must be completely unrelated news, during the final weeks of New York State budget negotiations, Governor Andrew Cuomo held a secret, private $5,000 minimum campaign fundraiser attended by lobbyists, real estate developers, and those doing business with the state. Who does Cuomo actually serve? As part of their energy democracy campaign to combat the tyranny of exchange value, the New York City Eco-Socialist Working Group is fighting Con Edison's 2019 rate case, which would increase electricity rates by 4.9% and gas rates by 9.1% for the 3.4 million customers. Con Edison terminated service for over 650,000 residents between 2010 and 2018, and forces the public to pay for crumbling fossil fuel infrastructure. Chairman, President, and Chief Executive Officer at Con Edison, John McAvoy, made over $8 million in total compensation. The essential questions at hand are, what actual work does he do? Do you really want a corporate bureaucrat to have dictatorial control of your community's energy resources? Meanwhile, in labor struggles here in New York, the nurses' fight for healthcare as a human right continues. Last week, the bargaining committee rescinded the strike notice because management came to the table with more money for staffing. However, it's become clear that the money being offered is not nearly sufficient. It's possible that they will put out another strike notice in the coming days. At the New York City DSA fundraiser for the Nurses Strike Fund last night, a member of the New York State Nurses Association declared that Mount Sinai has never gone on strike, but now 97% of nurses voted in favor of striking. We build momentum, solidarity, and unity. This is about more than individual demands. The sum of our efforts means breaking the despotism at our workplace. In other labor news, workers at McDonald's franchises in North Carolina went on strike today to protest against rampant sexual harassment they suffer on the job. Solidarity with workers everywhere fighting for a better world. The de Blasio administration continues to manipulate woke language to entrench the power of the ruling class. Its plan to open, quote, community jails in lieu of Rikers Island began its formal review this week. While right-wingers and their useful idiots in the liberal media continue to decry non-existent left-wing threats of political correctness, the police state has once again struck an actual blow to the right of free assembly. Two students at the University of Arizona will be charged with misdemeanors after a video showing them protesting in an ICE event went public. University of Arizona President Robert Robbins is quoted saying, "A dramatic departure from our expectations of respectable behavior and support for free speech on this campus." Meanwhile, ICE and the Border Patrol are running concentration camps filled with thousands of refugees seeking asylum on the U.S. border with Mexico. Who's the real threat to civil liberties? In Tennessee, a building at the Highlander Education and Research Center was destroyed in a fire last week. It appears that the Highlander Center fire may have been an arson attack perpetrated by white power militants. This occurred among a skyrocketing rate of extra-legal white supremacist actions across the country in the aftermath of Trump's election. Also this week, it's been reported that six major anti-racist organizers from Ferguson have turned up dead over the past few years. Anyone who knows the history of the violence of U.S. law enforcement and white supremacist paramilitaries towards black activists should be deeply suspicious of what's happening here. Stay safe out there, comrades.
Thanks very much to Jack Devine and The Thorn for those headlines. The NYC Thorn is a weekly newsletter that comes to your inbox from the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. Please subscribe at thethorn.nyc. So today's episode is going to bring a conversation about the role of money in politics, both the bad kind and the good kind, talking about the problems that we face as a result of systemic capture of our political system by moneyed interests, but then also how we raise funds in a grassroots way, in an ethical way, to support our candidates. So I'm Michael Carter. I got my start in the electoral world working for Bernie in New York and Los Angeles. I then went on to serve as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's deputy campaign manager. And I currently am working in the state Senate for Julia Salazar. So I have some electoral experience. We're welcoming here actor, comedian, and socialist organizer Simone Norman. She uses she, her pronouns, and she was the deputy finance director for AOC.
Hi.
Hey.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So, Simone, many anti-capitalist organizers, many socialist organizers, they focus on the shoe leather, the sort of volunteer engagement, the door knocking, all of that aspect. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little more, though, about why fundraising is important, even in a socialist context and an anti-capitalist context?
Yeah, definitely. First, it's probably good to raise the issue of money in politics in general. Like, we throw that around a lot, that term, money in politics. What does that mean? Because we're anti-capitalist organizers, we're socialists. So, you know, a lot of the times combining capital and organizing people balk at that. So I just want to talk about for a second, like, money in politics. Nationally, in terms of issues that we are organizing for, there's Medicare for All, there's climate justice, there's and eco-socialism. These are all things that we see a lot of dark money in politics in, right? We see like insurance companies and big pharma intervening in advocating and organizing for single-payer health care. Then we have the oil companies lobbying to electeds, preventing our eco-socialist goals from coming to fruition. And those are examples of big corporate money in politics and how it gets in the way of what we're trying to do. Locally in New York City, housing is a huge one. When I think of money in politics, I think of all the different real estate money that leads to the hyper-gentrification of our communities in New York City. It's happening in cities all over the country, but obviously we all feel the effects here. Having Amazon land in Queens, or at least they tried to, is an example of the way that big money and housing don't go very well together when you at least ask families, working class families. So basically, when I say like money in politics, the bad kind, quote unquote, bad kind of money in politics, we're talking corporate money. Money that has nothing to do with working families who are voting for candidates. And so if a candidate is accepting money from a corporation, if they're accepting money from a lobbyists, if they're accepting money that doesn't come from their potential constituents or from unions or from grassroots PACs or whatever, then they become beholden to those interests that don't have anything to do with, you know, with family. So I just wanted to give that brief overview. So because, you know, you can't say that we don't have money in politics as socialists, as grassroots. We do have money. It just comes from a different source. So like today, I wanted to talk a little bit about grassroots campaigns and the fundraising I did for Alexandria, the fundraising that we do for every candidate who's running. You know, we live in this society. We need to raise money for these candidates. And you have to get creative is what I'm probably want to talk about the most today, is how we get creative in order to do that.
So now, in terms of what that looks like from the bad side,
yeah,
you know, the way I've seen it or heard of it is a candidate will spend a great deal of time in their office or in a closed room calling lists of donors, right? People who are categorized as saying this person can probably max out. Mm-hmm. This person can give 100. This person has given 50 before, so maybe they'll give 50 more. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of members of Congress or other elected officials spend a great deal of their time doing that. So how is it different, the process, just like the nuts and bolts of doing grassroots political fundraising for, you know, let's say, for example, Alexandria or Julia Salazar or one of these other candidates?
Yeah, so you still need money, even if you're a grassroots candidate, and money doesn't come just falling out of the sky. Even for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, there was a time when she was not famous. No one knew who she was, and we were doing a lot of asking. And when you have a working class low-income community that you are fundraising in, you know, folks only have so much to give, and we don't want to drain the neighborhoods we're looking to improve or to, you know, whatever. So, yeah, there's a lot you have to do in terms of asking that usually ends up becoming more of a community ask instead of just, you know, calling a list and being like, can you donate this? Can you donate that? We like to get communities together and ask in that way. You know, have folks come out to an event, have folks come out to a skills lab, have folks come out to an organizing opportunity that also has a small fundraising component. I'm sure Alexandria, you know, you were working for her before I was. You know, she made calls, but the calls she was making were not to other electeds or lobbyists or companies or anything like that. The calls she was making were to friends and family or, you know, small business owners. It was just not the same at all. And it also takes up, you know, a fraction of the time that a candidate who isn't a grassroots candidate would otherwise spend on fundraising asks.
Yeah, I can perhaps speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, you were her fundraising director. I mean, it's no secret. You were her fundraising director before I was, and you were promoted to eventually deputy campaign manager. And in your absence, I got your job. So that was how I kind of came to be involved in Alexandria's world. And so I learned a lot from you in the grassroots fundraising capacity, just by watching it first and then by eventually just saddling up and doing it myself.
Yeah. So, I mean, the main tactics that we were able to really effectively use, we tried out call time. Mm. That didn't work so great, both because the networks available were not people with the most wealth in the world. So, yeah, you know, it's hard to ask people who are already struggling to donate in that way. Mm-hmm. But we did have a lot of success with, as you say, these small community events, like having a little fundraising party in somebody's dorm room, and sort of just like people in a high dollar situation, they're sort of expecting something for their money, mm-hmm. right? They're expecting, like, I'm purchasing access, I'm purchasing policy, I'm purchasing a relationship with this elected official. In a grassroots context, it's different.
Yeah.
What you're really doing is you're almost like you're purchasing an experience. You're purchasing ownership in a movement.
You're purchasing the beginning of a conversation. You know, like, I think something that you taught me about what it means to these folks to donate, folks who don't have a lot, but folks who are donating small dollar donations, what it means to them to donate to these campaigns is that I now get to have a conversation with you about how I want my community to look. And the donation is not the end of a transaction. It's the beginning of that continued conversation. And there are still activists that, you know, gave her $3 that keep in touch with her today.
So we're about to go to the break. When we get back, we're going to discuss a little more. What is this money actually used for? Why do these campaigns need so much money? And also, you know, concerns about how do you know that your donation is going to be used for the most efficient possible use? A lot of donors to the DNC in 2016 became very angry with the uses that their donations were put towards in the wake of, you know, that election.
Right. And I think that if you are a grassroots candidate asking for money, you have to have an incredibly strong platform while you're running, even before you've been elected, because then folks can know what it is that their dollar is going towards. If you don't have even a policy or platform page on your website, why would I donate to you? I don't know what it is you're going to do. Yeah.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBII in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com or sign up for our newsletter to get extra fun bits from the show. You can do that on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com. You can also find us on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, our topic is grassroots fundraising and its difference with big money corporate fundraising, and also tactics to do that, reasons to do that, uses for that money, especially in the context of electoral campaigns, although a lot of this also translates to our issue campaigns or our labor campaigns. So we are back in the studio. I'm back in the studio. I'm Michael Carter here with Simone Norman. Before we raise the question of how to raise funds for grassroots campaigns and also what it's used for. So Simone, do you have any examples of things that you need this for or pitfalls to avoid, things that people should keep an eye out on when they're looking at a campaign or an issue to donate to, deciding where to put their limited money?
Yeah, so I mean, the nuts and bolts of any campaign, you need to print literature. You need to hire organizers who can mobilize people to accomplish your goals. You need to rent an organizing headquarters, which is really expensive to rent in New York City.
Or anywhere, really.
Or anywhere. And sometimes you are going to need multiple offices if you're organizing across boroughs, as Alexandria did. She needed a Queens and a Bronx office. I remember you rented. You got the Bronx office was basically the back room of like a local taxi company, and so
yes, it was.
We were just a little anecdote. We would be sitting in there like doing organizing stuff or whatever, and then these taxi drivers would come running in and running in like, I gotta go pick someone up, like, and we're just huddled there. Oh my God. Yeah. And that's what, you know, then that was an exorbitant rent cost, even though we were sharing that space. So, yeah. So, you know, people think if you're anti-capitalist, you shouldn't be trying to raise money, but that's not how the world works. It's not realistic. All past revolutionary movement practices have involved some way of obtaining money. You can't do this work outside of society. But what I want to make the distinction between is it's not, you know, how much money do we need to raise? Like, what if we're grassroots? We shouldn't need to raise a lot. Like, that's not it at all. It's more, how do we make every dollar translate almost directly into field work?
Because that work, you know, from experience, that work is never done. So, you know, when somebody asks, "Oh, how much money do you need?" In reality,
infinite.
Infinite. You need infinite money.
We can do as much work as you can donate, kind of, you know, and we're going to get incredibly crafty on how to extend the life of the dollar as much as possible to get that return on investment. You know, like in AOC's race, for example, the money went very far. The breakdown of money, you know, to voter contact for the primary ended up being like $2 per potential voter, meaning that through targeted Facebook ads or literature printouts or canvassing, texting, phone banking operations, it only cost a few dollars to reach a voter and educate them on Alexandria. So if a dishwasher in Elmhurst donates $2 per month to the campaign, that dishwasher is personally responsible for several contacts with voters before Election Day, right? And that's huge. Alexandria only needed 15,000 voters to win her votes to win her primary, which is, I think, exactly as many as she got.
Very close to that number,
right.
Yes.
The campaign, you pretty much, and others, of course, pretty much figured out through math how many votes she needed to win, what the minimum was, and how much, you know, with that $2 per voter contact rate or whatever, you know, roughly, what could we do? And then you guys organized. It, you know, you overshoot it, but you organized exactly to the win number, and then look at that, the candidate wins.
Yeah, I mean, that really points to one of the issues that's sort of important on the other end of fundraising, which is the efficiency of the money mm-hmm. that's being used. You know, Crowley, in addition to ending his race with $1 million in the bank, he also spent a great deal of money on large full-page mailers, several of which did not have the election day on them.
Several of which got sent to Alexandria's apartment.
Which is...
She had like 10 of them by the time the election day came. She had collected all of them.
Well, she's a likely voter, so...
Yeah, she's a likely voter in his district.
Wanted to make sure that she knew who to vote for.
Yeah.
So that really speaks to some of the institutional corruption within the Democratic Party right now, mm-hmm. where... you know, before I entered this field, I didn't realize that politics is a business, that there are businesses who make their money, who make, you know, who pay people, who do salaries, who do all of this, mm-hmm. whose entire business is electoral campaigning. And there's that old joke. If you want job security, you should become a Democratic political consultant because you can continue to make mistakes and continue to lose and still be given the same contracts. So there's a certain way of doing it kind of within the beltway that, you know, some people ascribe to, some people don't. But when you look at these political conflicts, many of them are ideological, but many of them are also just based on these dollars and cents, like mm-hmm. who is aligned with what consulting firm in the city, mm-hmm. who likes to use which vendor. These are all very political questions. And so when you're considering donating to a candidate or raising money for a candidate, it's important that you sort of evaluate these things and you look into who this person is.
Right. And I think, you know, we were like so far away from the world of consulting. I mean, I'm sure that I think that there was some progressive independent consulting people we contract with. I don't actually know. But we were so far away from that. Like we were in people's living rooms. Trying to raise $500 in a night. And if we could do that, that was incredibly exciting. Because fundraising on a small scale like that, away with the constituents you're trying to have vote for you, is so much more impactful, so much more meaningful than like someone in a consultant's office typing up an email to people they will never meet. And like being in those rooms doing those house parties, which I can talk a little bit more about what the house party model means, it was really rewarding, those kinds of experiences where basically the candidate can come to a little like salon almost kind of style evening in your home if you live in her district their district and you want to vote for them. And Tiffany Caban is doing those now as we speak across Queens. They're really powerful moments, for sure.
So, obviously, for AOC, this worked out, despite expectations. But there are lots of other candidates out there who may not have her profile, but are still looking for that boost, still looking for the leftist community, the socialist community, the anti-capitalist community to come out and support them both in the streets and in terms of monetary contributions. So we have a pre-recorded segment here. We sent a volunteer to a fundraiser in New York City for four comrades in Chicago who are in runoffs to get on the city council there.
And there today is the election, by
today.
The way.
So if you're in the Chicago area,
go vote.
Go vote. And or even you could even donate. Maybe some of these candidates will have debt after their race.
They certainly will.
They almost certainly will, because that's
how it goes.
We could talk more about that. But there we go.
My name is Lillian Osborne, Carlos Rosa's field director. I'm from Chicago. I'm really excited to be here. This is amazing. Thank you so much for having us.
So we're here at this fundraiser in Bushwick for these candidates in Chicago. If you just want to give me a little bit of background about who you are and like how you came to be here.
Sure, yeah. My name is Eric Horowitz. I'm a Central Brooklyn DSA member. I've been meaning to go. I've been meaning to actually do something other than just get very, very angry, you know, at politics on a local and either both a local and a national level. You know, it's one thing to just sort of read the news and, you know, get all cross-eyed, and it's another thing to actually hit the streets and do it.
Sweet, sweet. So, have you done other organizing besides just the event here, the fundraiser tonight?
Yes, I've worked on Julia Salazar's campaign. I've worked on AOC's. By worked on, I mean, you know, I've knocked on a door and badgered someone to get a signature. But this part around is explicitly for the social aspect.
Got it.
Absolutely. I said I did. You know what? I did my time walking around. Now it's time to meet and greet fellow like-minded people who are just incredibly irritated with politics.
Well, I'm Karen Noreski. I'm a member of DSA in Central Brooklyn, but I'm actually from Chicago originally, so I'm really excited to see Chicago socialists supporting New York socialists and vice versa.
Okay, yeah. So my name is Deha Ko, and so I'm a member of North Brooklyn DSA. So that's largely the connection. You know, I also have other activist endeavors. It's like I'm also the legislative director for Wolfpack New York. I'm also a member of North Brooklyn Progressive Dems.
Why did you decide to come, like, specifically tonight? Like, why do you think it's important to give to the candidates, the Chicago candidates?
Well, I'm really excited that that Carlos Ramirez Rosa is here, but I'm also excited that he's potentially not going to be the only socialist on the city council in Chicago. So I'm hoping that I can help support him coordinate with the other DSA members and DSA candidates who are running in Chicago.
So I believe it's important if you want to build a true progressive movement, it's important to start from the ground up. So this means supporting local offices. To see someone like Carlos, get elected to the Chicago City Council is a significant step to to prying away against the Chicago Democratic machine.
You're an organizer within DSA. I'm sure you give your time. You pay at least yearly dues. Why is it that you want to give more? Like, what is it that drives you to come to this and give a little bit more to the cause?
Because I believe in these candidates. I believe in their vision. They have a stance.
Yeah, I mean, I am a monthly dues payer for DSA. DSA is doing so much different work. There's like so much happening, which is very exciting. But especially in politics, there is so much corporate money and so much money that's lined up against us. I think it's really important for us to be able to, you know, spread around the resources that we have to try to boost the good work that socialists are doing.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Karen.
Okay, so last but not least at all, Carlos Rosa.
Because when we have that socialist caucus, it's going to be a fighting force on that council that's going to agitate, that's going to move the conversation to the left, and it's going to make sure that working people, not just in Chicago, but all across this nation, know that there's a different path. And I want to make it very clear, I represent working people, right? Not the billionaire class, not the 1%, not the corporate class.
Hi, this is WBAI, listener-sponsored radio. I'm Michael Carter. This is Simone Norman. We're talking about grassroots fundraising versus more corporate, big money, big dollar fundraising. So we kind of started talking about before some of the things that this money goes towards in a well-run organization. And yeah, Simone, do you have any insight into like what to look for in an organization that's spending its money well?
Yeah. So, I mean, I love that segment because a lot of the times the candidate gets up there and like does their, you know, their stump, they talk about, but they don't talk about what it is they really need the money for.
Yeah.
They say, and I loved that segment, and I loved hearing about how excited they were to get together and like blow off steam. And but what are they actually getting out of the donations that they make to these? What are they getting when they chip in $3, when they chip in $300? Besides just knowing like, okay, that helps. Candidates need to raise this money to not just get by the nuts and bolts of the things like clipboards and you know, office supplies and stuff like that, but also it's really important to be able to reflect in your campaign the kind of things that you want to see in your community.
Absolutely.
So, like, if your big promise is to expand and increase healthcare, then you better be, you know, providing your staffers with health insurance. You better be paying them a fair minimum wage of $15 or more. If you can, you know, there's a lot of volunteer work on campaigns, but if you're paying anyone to organize for you, like by canvassing, then you better be paying them $15 an hour as well. And, you know, those fair labor practices, as well as making sure that you're contracting with union-made like t-shirt companies and printing, you know, printers and stuff like that. There's just so much, there's so much, so many transactions that have to happen in while you're running a campaign, from paying your staff to running this operation with all these different materials, t-shirts and literature and da da da, to renting space for when you need to host events, to renting your office, and all of these things. If you're not spending the money in a way that reflects your policy, then you know, that's not so great. So, I mean, that's something we tried to really look to do with Alexandria.
And I can definitely speak to the utility of organizers.
Yeah.
There is no substitute for a full-time dedicated organizer with a given turf that they're supposed to work in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, volunteers are awesome and should continue to be used as much as possible. But what that means is, and this is the model that sort of the rest of the party has used, only privileged people, only people with, you know, expendable income, only people who are independently wealthy are able to actually participate if you're restricting electoral work to being just volunteer opportunities.
Right.
When you have strong, well-paid organizing and canvassing jobs, you can afford to find people in your community who may already be doing some organizing, but just sort of on the side, besides their day job, besides their family, besides whatever else they have going on.
Right. Like that guy who said in the thing we just heard, I've done the work knocking on doors. Now I'm here for the social aspect. You know what I mean? Like, these folks are doing this in their spare time. They're expending all this labor,
mm-hmm.
a lot of these volunteers. And they feel like really a part of the movement when you give them the opportunity to do that, when you expand past who typically helps out on a campaign, and also who typically shows up to a fundraiser.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it can be very helpful too to have a very specific, concrete ask. For most of the very early go of it with Alexandria, our big ask, the thing that we would say at every fundraising event was, we need a physical office. We need a space. Rent is too
high. Right, it really helps to let your donors know what you are doing with their money like tomorrow.
And so we've sort of touched upon many of the physical aspects in the field compartment of the campaign, which, in as you know, in my opinion, is the most important part.
Yes, field first.
Field first is what we went by and what seemed to work this time around.
And it's Tiffany is doing really well with the field first, too. I saw the other day that something like they submitted 10,000 signatures to the Board of Elections, and the DSA was responsible for roughly 6,000 of those signatures
yes,
to
indeed.
Get her on the ballot. So field
and
first.
So that being said, there are other things that campaigns can spend money on, some of which are good expenditures. One of them is a professionally made campaign video. This was very important for Alexandria because this video, which we had no money for at the time, we ended up paying for at a discounted rate, but it cost, I think, like $4,000.
Which is so much to money for where Alexandria was at that time.
And it's,
that was maybe, what, half of what she had probably or something?
Pretty much half. And that's, and so that not only was that a lot for what she had at the time, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny amount for what most people would charge for that quality of product.
And all, I mean, like, to put that into perspective, like, in terms of you're talking money in these early stages, putting together something like a video costs, like, Joe Crowley spent $40,000 just on the organizers or on the paid canvassers who went out and collected signatures to get him on the petition. $40,000 on a petition operation that Alexandria ran for free with volunteers. And then, I mean, she spends $4,000 on this video by a small business, Means of Production, which is a Detroit-based production company who came over here and did her video for her. And it went so viral on the internet, you know, that then small dollar donations started pouring in from the rest of the country. So it's just like the way that you build, the way that you build your base, the way that you build your the source of your donations.
You need that early investment.
You need that early investment. And just knowing where to spend your money and when is really difficult for a grassroots candidate, especially one who, is running for the first time and is kind of just doing what they think is right, running on intuition and the counsel of who they surround themselves with.
Yeah, and I mean, that's, I don't know, folks, if they know about Emily's List, which is a, you know, a corporate democratic organization intended to bring, get more women into office, right? Emily, that word, even although it is also a name, stands for Early Money Is Like Yeast. It's weird. They're weird. But what that means from a practical perspective is that the earlier money comes in, the more other money it can attract. This is a principle that, you know, was developed for a corporate campaign, but does work for a grassroots campaign.
Yeah, and I just want to say also shout out to Emily's List for being terrible. But sorry, moving on. What they're saying in the premise of their name is true. It's for sure, and it is applicable. You can take these big corporate models and kind of scale them down to. And if you just suck the corporate interest out of them, then they're just good business models. If they're being funded by small dollar donations by your own friends, family, and fans, then they work. But when they become, you know, bloated kind of corporate, you know, I won't continue. You know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
They're not as fun anymore.
No, they're not as much fun.
I wanted to actually ask you something, Michael.
Okay.
If I'm allowed.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So you were the fundraising director before I was.
Indeed.
And I want to get your thoughts on why you believe people make these donations to grassroots causes, even if they only have a little bit to give, and how you make that happen.
So the key here is realize that at this point, no elected official would be seen with us. It was really hard to book space because of people who were afraid about retaliation. Nobody who was donating or who was showing up or was doing anything with our campaign was doing so in expectation of a political, monetary, or other kind of reward, because nobody thought we would win.
Right.
So you do have this issue in some other grassroots campaigns, which I want to caution people about, which is individuals who, you know, you should feel free to use their resources, but you should make sure that they don't believe that there's any strings attached.
Right.
Nobody was offering us any strings because they didn't think we were worth it at the time.
So you're just making folks feel like they're being advocated for directly. Represented.
Yeah. So what I tried to do is with these smaller parties, with these fundraising events, is find people with that sincere belief in the cause,
mm-hmm.
and get them bought into the campaign.
Right.
So see that donation as the beginning of a conversation,
mm-hmm.
not the end of a conversation,
right.
where you know this person, they at least have $10 riding on your victory. Like, they would be happy if you won. They're not going to get anything concrete from it, but presumably they want us to win, which is why they donate.
Right.
So if they want us to win, then you can come back to that person and say, hey, like, can you do a petitioning shift? Hey, do you have any, you know, physical resources you can donate? Can we use your car? Can we sort of can we raise you up on the ladder of engagement with a campaign?
Mm-hmm.
And so blending it all together like that, making it clear that it's not like your donors and your volunteers are totally different categories that don't talk to each other, but that you are a community of people mm-hmm. that are working together to create something new.
Right.
That can create a powerful sense of identity, a powerful sense of belief in people.
And there's also because, you know, like you're saying, they're not different categories of people, the donors and the volunteer. Like, you might make the argument, like, why? What if you're doing well? What if you don't really feel like you need to be advocated for? What if you're just spending your free time? Like, what about those people? What about somebody who says, like, I don't feel like these issues affect me? What would you say to them to get them to maybe make a donation?
So, first of all, in New York, it's a little bit easier because the easy enemy is your landlord. Everyone pays rent. And the thing that I would see that people would really take notice of is when you would say, we take no donations from real estate developers. We take no corporate donations. What you want to do is show people how their daily lives, the amount of rent they pay, the fact that they have to move every year, the fact that their entire community is disappearing to move somewhere else, and say, you know why that happens? It happens because of the influence of capital on our political system.
And it's systemic.
And it's systemic, and it's all the way up and down.
Yeah, if you think it doesn't affect you, you're incorrect, pretty much.
And you know, I'll never forget canvassing for Bernie in a public housing project in Brooklyn. And I said, hey, this was when he wasn't as famous. And he's like, hey, this is this guy, Bernie. He's pretty cool. I think he would be a good president. And this like young kid, he's like 16. He's like, oh, so like you're saying he's for the people. And I'm like, yeah, you completely get it.
Wow.
Like if you really just talk with people a little bit and try to understand what their issue is.
Meet them where they are.
It becomes clear how politics is affecting them, even if they don't understand how it is. So you are listening to WBAI 99.5 Radio Revolutions Per Minute, a show from the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. We're about to open up our phone lines for our callers, so please call in. The studio line is 212-209-2877. Once again, our studio line is 212-209-2877.
Ask us questions. I'm so fun to chat with.
She is. So,
but before that.
Yeah, before, you know, there were people calling, but we should still talk, you know.
Yeah, I think I want to quickly say before we get into those phone calls that I want to tell a little story.
Okay.
I'll tell it quickly. Okay, do you remember when we went to in Queens to Brother Rashid's house?
I do.
For a fundraiser? Okay. So this guy is this local organizer in Queens, Muhammad Rashid. Shout out to him. He's amazing. And it was such a different type of fundraiser that you would like ever think of. When you think of the term fundraiser, you think of what, like $10,000 a plate? That's the kind of fundraiser that Joe Crowley would go to or host for himself. And this was so different. This was this Bengali family that was hosting us. There were four generations of them there, men, women, children, grandparents, a very scary dog that was barking at us in the front, but was actually really a sweetheart, and so much food. And Alexandria shows up and she's introduced to all of the entire family, the cousins, the grandparents, the babies, on three different levels of the house. And we all ate together. We told stories. And had a whole dialogue. She took questions. She took photos. And then at the end of that whole night, the elders in the family felt comfortable writing like a modest check to her and pledging their support to her. And what I want to really, why I wanted to tell a story and what I really wanted to take away from that whole anecdote is the importance of a donation in many of these communities is that it's a token of someone's continued support. And it is something that they can't do by just going to her website and being like, sure, I'll donate, or reading an email, or, you know, it was done in such a direct, meaningful, community-centered, like breaking bread together, traditional way that was so far from, you know, text this number to donate or Venmo us or whatever. Like, when you're fundraising for a grassroots candidate, you can't be afraid to get up close and personal with these folks who you're meeting, and appealing to the way they feel comfortable donating money, because it's not always going to be with a Square card at a concert. You know what I mean? So that's just like a little story I wanted to tell.
Yeah, you definitely have to look at how people feel comfortable, both in terms of age range, in terms of, you know, as millennials, we can often sort of assume that everybody can access things like links, you know, right, a credit card reader, something like that. You really having the ability for people to donate with cash or check can be very important, especially in, you know, older senior communities, in immigrant communities. Mm-hmm. So,
to have like physical envelopes on us all the time that you could stuff cash or, checks into, and then you write all of your FCC, information on the like front of the envelope. Like, that was so clutch. That was huge for the entire thing.
So we're about to have a caller, it sounds like.
Ooh.
They're about to be on the air. Hi, I'm Michael with Revolutions Per Minute at the WBAI radio station, 99.5. What's your question?
Hi, Michael. My name is Victor Monterosa, and I am a leftist. I'm a revolutionary. I was born in Brooklyn. I grew up in Newark, and I'm a people's lawyer. I was a tenant organizer for 10 years, and last year I decided to run for a city council here in Newark, which was really difficult because the political machine here, the Democratic machine, is pretty much a statewide organization, and the county machine is very, very strong. So a couple of questions that I had is, for someone like me who was starting from scratch, and I was able to put together a team of four people, and we really started from the very, very grassroots. We had won a few tenant organizing campaigns, but we really didn't have any money. And then we tried and we started getting some funds. But I'm wondering, with a nascent organization like that, what are some of the recommendations you have in terms of from the very beginning? And also, how would you suggest that? It was difficult for us, for example, to get the money for, I really wanted to pay people $15 an hour. I really wanted to buy the union made stuff. I really wanted to make sure that we did things that were a lot more ethical. And I'm just wondering if when there is no money, if you have any suggestions as to how to tackle that.
Yeah, that's a really hard thing to deal with. And first of all, thank you for your work. It's great that
you
are organizing tenants, running for office. And that's the kind of local level race against the machine that needs these kinds of tactics. I guess what I would say in terms of getting things off the ground is, once you have your message, you then need to I would have these small house parties, raising small amounts of money at a time with members of the community you're hoping to represent, as small as like five or six people, mm-hmm. each of whom can donate $20, bring a little food, a little drink, and sort of try to scale up from there. I would say that it's incredibly difficult. And I don't know. I don't know what your campaign was like, but I'm not going to get on your case in terms of how much you may have paid your people or not.
I also want to say you should, my advice is to make sure that every single organizing opportunity is a fundraising opportunity, and every single fundraising opportunity is an organizing opportunity. Never limit yourself to either or. every single time you have a fundraiser, you should have sign-up sheets for canvassing or sign-up sheets to start volunteering or get the mailing list. Every single time you have folks getting an email that tells them about their shift to go and canvass, they should also at the bottom of the email have a donate link. You should, and even the bigger fundraisers we did, like when we had a big, nice blowout concert at a bar in Queens or whatever, with lots of amazing music for Alexandria or whatever, and we were raising at that point more money, and still in the order of just several thousand, never really more than that. But we still had sign-up sheets to canvass. We still had literature there that we wanted you to take home and hand out. Like, you should always be compounding on the effects of like this dual relationship between fundraising and organizing. They don't have to exist in different worlds. That's my advice.
Yeah, thank you so much for your call. We're almost out of time, but I really wanted to make sure that we talk to you, Simone, about, so how can people get involved with grassroots fundraising themselves? I know you have an event that you're putting on, but then also in general.
Yeah, I just want to say, first of all, you can always get in touch with the electoral working group of the DSA if you want to organize with them for candidates. But you can, you know, take this model of house parties. Hit me up on social media if you want to know what that really means, because it's not like Aaron Carter's house party. It's like a little different. And I can explain to you how that goes. But in terms of concrete, like call to action, things I'd love for folks to get involved with, especially those who live in New York City. Coming up, we have a really fun fundraiser that I'm hosting for the NYC DSA PAC. It's called How the Left Was Won, which is an adorable pun I came up with. And it is organized, we're going to be doing this fundraiser to benefit DSA-endorsed NYC and New York State candidates, such as Tiffany Caban, who is running for Queens DA. You can get tickets for that at, it's a bit.ly link, so bit.ly/leftwaswon. That is bit.ly/leftwaswon. Please, you can donate there if you want to just donate to the PAC and not actually attend the event, but we would love for you to come. We have a partner on Churla headlining it, and Artie Galopity and Lorelai Ramirez and Emmy Blotnick and all these amazing folks. It's on April 10th at Sunnyvale in Brooklyn at 8 o'clock. Yeah, so that is a little bit about the upcoming event. And then I want to also say a little bit about what a DSA PAC looks like.
Yeah, why do we have a PAC?
Yeah, so PACs get a bad rap because obviously there's some really bad ones out there. But a political action committee is just, I think it's more complicated than just a savings account, but it's just a coffer of funds that you can use for your political goals. And in terms of what that means for the DSA specifically in New York City is that we have a citywide electoral team that is supporting local and state candidates that are running for office. And so the PAC is going to hold on to funds to support those candidates by buying materials, by organizing canvassers, by all the things we've mentioned before that someone needs in order to run a field operation. We go out there and we hit the ground and we hit the streets for those candidates that we endorse. So we did that for Julia Salazar, who won her state senate seat. We're doing it for candidates like Tiffany Caban now, and we're going to do it next year in 2020 for the city and state candidates that we endorse then. And then the other thing I want to say about the PAC is that a lot of times, you know, when you have we want to be a resource to candidates who wouldn't otherwise be able to run, like women, working class folks, organizers, people of color, like Alexandria was, like Julia Salazar. We have that money to kind of uplift their operations. So if you want to donate to the PAC, anything you donate through the link I just mentioned will go there, but you can also actually donate to us through Venmo at, wait, let me find the exact link for that. It's the handle is NYCDSAPC. Yeah, so please come out to that event and donate, and we love you. Vote for Tiffany Caban.
We love you. Solidarity. Vote today, Chicago. Thank you very much.